turn to Romans again. I don't know where that came from. Matthew chapter 9. We're returning to the last four verses of Matthew chapter 9. And as we're turning to this passage, many of you might already recognize that we are turning to a section that has headlined countless missions conferences, evangelistic seminars, and sermons on personal evangelism over the years. And we're gonna press into this call as we apply this passage, as we work through it. But as we begin this morning, I want to start this morning by taking a quick look in the rear view mirror so that we can see the beauty and intentionality of Matthew's storytelling that we have in the text today. The literary genius, by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is amazing in this book. To begin with, as we turn to chapter 9, verse 35, we're going to get there just in a moment. But when we get to verse 35, Matthew is going to be using verse 35 to help us recognize that he's making a transition in his book. He's making a transition from the words, the teaching, and the works and the miracles of Jesus to the broader mission of Jesus and his disciples. And the way he's doing this is he's using a literary device. So three people in the church look up and say, "Literary device, yes, show me where." It's a literary device known as inclusio. You don't have to remember that. You can think of it like those bookends that you use to hold up the books on your shelf. You know, it's like they fall over on their own, so you put a bookend on one end and a bookend on the other, and they hold everything in place. And Matthew is doing this in a literary fashion, because inclusio is simply this. It's the intentional repetition of words, phrases, or themes that an author uses to mark the beginning and the end of a literary unit. Let me show you what I mean. We're going to go to the very beginning of this section, Matthew chapter 4, verse 23, right before the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew gives us this summary statement. "And he," that is Jesus, "went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people." And isn't that what we saw? We saw it began with the Sermon on the Mount. Three chapters of teaching. Two chapters now, chapters 8 and 9, on miracles and healing. We've seen what Matthew told us Jesus was doing. Verse 35 of chapter 9 today. "And Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction." Jesus is doing the same thing. He's summarizing. He's saying, like, "Look, I've been telling you something, and here are the main boundaries of what I'm telling you." And as we look at the inside, we look at Jesus' teaching in chapters 5 through 7, it concluded with a statement about his authority. Jesus taught as one with authority, not like the scribes and the Pharisees. And in chapters 8 and 9, we learn that Jesus had the authority to forgive sins, to heal diseases, to calm raging storms, to drive out demons, to raise the dead. Even more, this last week we learned that Jesus was the authoritative Messiah of Israel. And as we look forward to this next week, we'll just take a little peek into chapter 10, verse 1. Jesus is now going to do something with his authority after our passage today. Chapter 10, verse 1, "And he called to him his 12 disciples." And what does he do? He gives them authority. Jesus is the one with all authority, and he gives it to his disciples, authority over the unclean spirits, and to cast them out, and to heal every disease and every affliction. And why is it so necessary for Jesus to share his authority with his disciples? We find the answer in our text today. The answer is simply this: people are the mission. People are the mission. We see this in verses 25 through 26. Little pedantic. people are the mission. Verses 37 through 38. Because people are the mission, what does Jesus want his disciples to know? Passivity is not an option. And why is passivity not an option? Because people are the mission. Let's turn to our text starting in verse 35. Again, and Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Now, as we dig into these first two verses, we might be tempted to skip over 35 because we've already identified it as a restatement of chapter 4, verse 23. But we want to take just a minute here because this verse is more than the literary bookend of chapters 5 through 9. No, this verse highlights the comprehensive scope of Jesus' ministry throughout the region of Galilee. And I say comprehensive because Matthew employs the Greek adjective all three times in this one little verse. So it's not all each time in our passage, but in the Greek it's all. We see it. Jesus went through all the cities and villages teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel. And what did he do? He healed every disease. That is, all diseases. He healed every affliction, all afflictions. Jesus healed. His ministry in the region of Galilee is utterly comprehensive. He's come to proclaim the good news of the gospel to every town and every city and every little place people are congregated around the region. And at the same time, Jesus ministers to specific people, not just to the masses. He interacts with individual people and he heals them of their diseases and their afflictions. In fact, some scholars would even say it's very possible that Matthew bookends this section as he does because Jesus took two ministry trips around Galilee. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, we don't know. Yet as Matthew quickly transitions to verse 26, he points us to something much more than the scope of Jesus' ministry. He points us to the explicit focus, the focus of his ministry. Verse 36, when Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Let's just take a minute and orientate ourselves to this shepherding metaphor for a moment. I mean, above any other domestic animal that God has created, to my knowledge, sheep may be among the most dim-witted animals that God has created. Like when they're left on their own, they can hardly find the right kind of food to eat. They'll eat almost anything. They'll eat poisonous plants and kill themselves. They get afraid of fast-moving water. They'll just die of thirst right next to a stream because it's moving too fast. They can hardly stay out of trouble in the best of circumstances. Make matters worse. Sheep are utterly defenseless against predators. They don't have any claws. They got teeth, but they're not that mean. Right? They got no way. Nothing they can do. And one of the things that, like, if you've been a Christian for any length of time, you know that this metaphor of sheep and sheep needing shepherds is a prominent metaphor throughout the entire Bible, talking about God's people and their need for godly leaders, right? So when Matthew tells us that the people are like sheep without a shepherd, he's telling us that they've been virtually abandoned by their spiritual leaders. And what's their condition? When Jesus is going through the towns and villages, he just doesn't see the physical sickness and the disease and the demonic oppression, though it is real and it is there, and he engages it. He sees people that are harassed. This word here is gives us the picture of disheveled, torn apart, molested, and actually filleted wide open. So we're talking about torn open sheep. Helpless means to be thrown down and to be scattered. It's not a pretty scene that Matthew paints for us in these two words. But in it, Matthew wants to see these people are not just suffering under disability and disease and demons. It's like they're suffering, but that's not the only problem. No, they're like sheep under the constant attack of vicious predators. This is why Jesus has compassion on his people. And by compassion, Matthew is not saying Jesus has this general feeling of sadness and sympathy for his people. Like he employs this Greek term here behind compassion. And it's this incredibly strong term for emotions. It's if like we translated it literally, it'd be like bowels, your internal organs. And they used it to denote deep, visceral emotions. You know, have you ever seen somebody like get hurt and they're bleeding, like really bad, and like you just feel it. You see somebody in a bad situation. And or you even hear about it, and it's like you, it's not just like, oh, that's bad. It's like it overwhelms you with the feeling. Like I feel right now for what I'm even seeing. And therefore we could say that in many ways, when Jesus has compassion on the people, Jesus is cut to the heart. He's not emotionless. He's cut to the heart and he's compelled to action when he sees the desperate condition of his people. And that's good news for us, isn't it? He sees and he knows. But it leaves us with an important question as we look at this. Like who are these predators? Why, how and why are they being torn apart? Like is Jesus angry at the way his people are being abused by their Roman overlords? After all, they've been occupied for quite some time now. Matthew himself was a tax collector. We might be tempted to think so. But Matthew's audience would have recognized that in this little short verse, Matthew is actually leveraging an Old Testament theme that ultimately highlights a much darker truth. See, on the one hand, this theme was used to emphasize Israel's need for faithful leaders. This first comes up in Numbers chapter 27. Moses is on the mountain. He's about to die. God says, hey, look at the promised land, you're not going in. And here's Moses' plea. Moses spoke to the Lord saying, let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who shall go out before them and come in before them, who should lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep without a shepherd. God, give them a godly leader, a man who can do the job. Because if not, it's just going to be a mess. God appoints Joshua. We see it in this positive sense, but more often than not, we see it in a negative sense in the Old Testament. This metaphor of sheep and shepherds was used to condemn, throughout the Old Testament, it was used to condemn Israel's leaders for their failure to lead. And Matthew seems to be alluding to, and that means pointing us back to, one of the most scathing indictments against Israel's shepherds in the Old Testament. Ezekiel chapter 34. There's a lot here. We're going to kind of jump through key sections of it, beginning in verse 1. The word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. prophesy and say to them, even to the shepherds, thus says the Lord God, O shepherds of Israel, who have been feeding yourselves? Shouldn't shepherds feed the sheep? We can jump down to verse 5, which is really the close contact with our passage today. So they were scattered. Scattered because there was no shepherd, and they became food for all of the wild beasts. My sheep were scattered. Jumping down to verse 9, therefore, God says, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against the shepherds, and I will require my sheep at their hand and put a stop to their feeding the sheep. No longer shall the shepherds feed themselves. Now listen to this. I will rescue my sheep from whose mouths? The shepherd's mouths. That they shall not be food for them. Who are the predators? Who are the ones that are actually eating the sheep? Not in a literal sense like cannibalism, but abusing them and taking advantage of them. In Ezekiel, it's not the nations. It's not the pagan nations. No. It was the shepherds of Israel. It was Israel's leaders. The shepherds were neglecting and abusing and eating the sheep. They're taking advantage of them. And Matthew alludes to this very episode in Israel's history with Jesus pointing back to the Old Testament shepherds because he wants us to see and he wants his audience of every age to see that Israel's current shepherds, the scribes and the Pharisees that we've seen so far, later on, the Sadducees and the priesthood itself. He wants us to see that these leaders, these shepherds are guilty of the same thing. We're going to see this play out over and over again as we work our way through the rest of the gospel. Like we've already seen there's conflict between Jesus and the shepherds, but it's only going to get worse. And it's because as Jesus is going to show us, the scribes and the Pharisees are more concerned about their status before men, and they are more concerned about the enforcement of their oral traditions, their personal little laws that they've added on top of the law of Moses. They're more concerned about those things than loving and serving and caring for God's people. They're more concerned about teaching their traditions than they are teaching their people to love the Lord their God with all their heart and with all their soul and with all their mind and all their strength. What does God want? He's not looking just for law keepers. The law keepers is to expose our sin and expose our need. It's there to help us understand his character and his righteousness. But what does he want? He wants us to love him more than anything else in the world. And in their faithlessness, these leaders have turned them away from their love for God to love anything else but God. As we turn back to Ezekiel 34, what does God promise to do? This is where it gets really good. He promises to rescue his sheep from the shepherds' mouths. He promises to punish his shepherds for their failure and to personally tend, here it is, to tend his sheep as their shepherd. Verse 15, I myself will be the shepherd of my sheep. I myself will make them lie down, declares the Lord. I will seek the lost. I will bring back the strayed. I will bind up the injured. I will strengthen the weak. And the fat and the strong I will destroy. I will feed them in justice. God's going to step in. Because who owns the flock? God owns the flock. Whether it be the Old Testament people of Israel or God's new covenant people, the church, God owns the flock. Verse 22, I will rescue my flock. They shall no longer be prey. I will judge between sheep and sheep. And how is God going to do this? What's it going to look like? Verse 23, and I will set over them one shepherd, my servant David, who shall feed them He shall feed them and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I am the Lord. I have spoken. What is God saying here? I'm going to send my promised Messiah. That's how this is going to happen. Now, with that in mind, the promises of Ezekiel 34, let's now think about where we've just been in the Gospel of Matthew. Just this last week, what did we hear come out of the mouths of two blind men? Have mercy on us, Son of David. Just this last week, right before this, who is coming? Who's arriving? Who's on the scene? It's the promised Son of David. God's Messiah is here. When's the last time we heard the word prince? We heard it come out of the Pharisee's mouth after Jesus took and drove out the demon out of the demon-possessed guy. And they're trying to say Jesus is performing his miracles by the prince of demons. Jesus isn't performing his miracles by the prince of demons, no. No, he's the promised prince of Isaiah, of Ezekiel. Jesus is the promised shepherd. He's the promised shepherd. He sees the need of his sheep. He sees the dereliction of duty among the shepherds. Jesus is seeking the lost. He's binding their wounds. He's strengthening the weak. And yes, yes, he is facing ever-increasing conflict with the shepherds. In fact, now when we come back to that word compassion, Jesus having compassion on his people, I would like to suggest that Jesus isn't only having this deep-seated concern for his people. I wouldn't be surprised if it's mixed with white-hot anger for the failure of Israel's leaders. Jesus has compassion on his people, and he is not going to stand for what the leaders have been doing. And why? Because from the foundation of the world, people are the mission. Yet the moment we say people are the mission, it's a great slogan. But the very moment that we say people are the mission, we need to pause and clarify the ultimate goal of this mission, because we can instantly end up into one of two ditches on the side of the road, right? But like on the one hand, the mission, when we say people are the mission is not to blindly support the self-perceptions, the beliefs, and the practices of every person we meet. Nor is it to focus exclusively on people's felt needs. Exclusively. Now we see it very clearly in verse 34. Jesus traveled through every town and village out through the region of Galilee. And what was the first thing that Jesus did? In the towns and in the synagogues, he was proclaiming the gospel. He was proclaiming the message that they needed to hear. There's something they needed to know. But because the ultimate goal, the ultimate reason that Jesus came, we already found out in Matthew chapter 1, verse 21, is to save his people from their sins. That's what the angel tells Joseph about the son that Mary's having. She will bear a son. You'll call his name Jesus. Why? For he's going to save his people from their sins. I think we all know Jesus didn't heal every single sick person in Israel. He didn't restore every disabled. He did many. He came to preach. Yet the moment that the moment that we affirm this ultimate goal, the reason that Jesus came, we can quickly stumble into the ditch on the other side of the road. We can emphasize our teaching mission so much that we practically ignore the needs of those around us. Whether those needs be physical or emotional or spiritual or financial. Like we can be so focused on making sure we don't miss the proclamation of the gospel, the main thing, that we start treating it as the only thing. And you know the scary truth? The scary truth is that this error is much closer to the Pharisees' error than the previous. It's closer. Not exactly the same, but it's closer. But Jesus didn't pit his preaching ministry against his caring ministry. They're not at odds with one another. No, they go hand in hand. The preaching ministry, always the ultimate, the most important, but right next to it and just underneath it is the caring ministry of Jesus. Therefore, when we say people are the mission, when we say people are the mission, we're saying our mission is to love and support those who are suffering with physical and financial and relational and spiritual needs. We want to be there for them. And we love them the best. We love them the best when our support is bathed in the gospel. The proclamation of the gospel for those who have not yet come to faith in Christ. And the comfort of the gospel. And all of the implications that it entails for those that do know Christ. As John Piper put it at the Lausanne Conference for Missions in 2010, our mission is to care about all suffering, especially human suffering. Care about all suffering, especially eternal suffering. This is what we mean when we say people are the mission. We care about all suffering, but especially human suffering. And when people are the mission, people are the mission, Jesus wants us to know that passivity is not an option. It's not an option. Verse 37. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few." Notice he's pivoting metaphors. Harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into the harvest. Now, we gotta kind of point out something that is just like obvious. But, you know, we're humans and we can miss the obvious. Jesus never operates by the motto, "If you want to do something right, you got to do it yourself." He never operates by the motto, "If you want to do something right, you got to do it yourself." No, even though he was God incarnate, he didn't try to do all the work himself. As a man, he knew he couldn't personally care for every person on the planet. He could only be in one place at one time. Fully God, fully man, but present in one place as Jesus. Even more, his time on earth, he knew, was incredibly limited. His ministry years, three and a half years, that's it. So he pulled his disciples aside to reveal the true urgency of the mission that lay before him. Says the harvest is plentiful. Harvest is plentiful. The laborers are few. And we see this kind of urgency that Jesus is raising. And I think we've had that kind of urgency intersect our lives in various ways. Some of you have had to make cross-country moves with little or no preparation. Maybe you're in the military, something changes, man, we're moving you. job changes, you're moving across, things are happening in life. Some of you have had medical problems that have completely reorientated your life priorities, urgent things that change everything. And almost anybody who's ever had a job and served an employer has been given impossibly large tasks with no support, right? Here's this task. We need you to do it. It needs to be done now. And you don't have any support. And it's even better after they've like laid off most of your department and you're like the only one left holding the bag. And what generally happens is most of the time we find some way to make it work, but what does it cost? It costs hundreds of extra hours of unpaid overtime to make sure we get the job done. Other times we fail just because it's far too big for us to handle. But this imagery of harvest, plentiful harvest, depicts an even greater urgency that in our modern age we can sometimes be a little oblivious to. We can be oblivious to it because where do we get our produce? Safeway. Costco, Red Apple, pick your place, right? I mean, farmers. What's the goal of every farmer? They want to have a bountiful crop. I can't think of a farmer that plants every spring and says, you know what? I'm not too worried if a crop comes or not, or I don't want it to be too big. No, they want a bountiful crop. The greater the harvest, the greater reward, whether that be for just food security or whether that be for profitable sales. But the blessing of a bountiful crop, the kind of crop that Jesus is talking about, presents a farmer with a very acute threat. You can't do anything with that crop until it's brought in, right? While it's in the field, it can be destroyed by rodents. While it's in the field, it can be destroyed by the weather. And if you're not fast enough, it might simply rot in the field. Recent data, 2024. American farmers lost a combined $21 billion to weather events alone that prevented them from bringing their harvest in. $21 billion. Harvest is plentiful. But as long as it's sitting out the field, the goal isn't realized. It's got to be brought in. A bountiful harvest requires an abundance of workers. Yet at the very moment, where we might expect Jesus to do something like we experience often in life, when there's a big job to do and somebody knows they have a big job to do and there's other people around them, what do they tend to do? Manipulate and pressure, right? We start to try to figure out ways to pull people in, and we can be manipulative, and we can pressure, and we can drive them to do something. And we experience at every level. We experience from our bosses. We've experienced from our parents. We've probably experienced from our spouses. We've experienced it. But Jesus doesn't pressure them into participation. No, the first thing he does is he points them to the urgency of the harvest. And the very next thing, he calls them to pray. To pray that God would send workers into the harvest. And in so doing, Jesus gives us the key to effective evangelism, effective service in the local church, and effective missions across the world. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. Just to state it one more time. The urgency of the harvest didn't lead Jesus to turn to his disciples and say, "Get off your behind Get out in the field. Stop playing video games. Stop watching the news. No. No. Ask the Lord. Ask God the Father to send workers into his harvest fields. The harvest owner. This is important for us to understand as Christians. The harvest owner is ultimately responsible to send workers into his field. It's his harvest. He owns it. Within the church, as Christians, this helps us see that our task is not to frantically run around and try to do everything that needs to be done and find a way to make it all come together. And I can confess that I can be tempted to do that. I think many of us are. Even more as we think about, you know, Jesus just not being, you know, saying like, if you're going to do it right, do it yourself. I don't know how many times in 30 years of ministry I've heard people say, well, I'll do that as long as I can do it my way, as long as I don't have to report to anyone, as long as I don't have to have a committee. Everybody wants to do it their own way. He says our task is to pray. Our task is to pray and trust that God will direct our path as we serve him. And to pray that God will raise up the right people in the right place at the right time to serve in his harvest field. And this isn't passive. The reason it feels passive is because as American Christians, most of us have a very low view of prayer. We don't have the kind of view of prayer that Jesus has. We pray seldomly. Rarely, over small things. Rarely do we come to him with kingdom priorities that are at the center of God's heart, like this. And we can point out that in this next week, the very people that Jesus calls to pray are the very first people who end up going into the field. Which might be another reason people don't want to pray. Here am I, Lord. Send Jim. But I'd like to highlight 2 points of application here. 2 points as we wrap things up this morning. The first is this. We've just said it, but I want to reinforce it. The mission belongs to God. Our primary task is prayer. Primary, not only. Our primary task is prayer. In fact, as I was thinking about it this week in my office, Jesus' command to pray here in this passage and to pray for workers is nothing more than really a specific application of the opening verses of the Lord's Prayer. Specific application of the general statement. And when we went through the Lord's Prayer, we talked. Like, these are categories to pray through. Like, drop-down menus that all sorts of things can fit up and in. So let's go back to Matthew chapter 6, verse 9. Pray then like this. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So what does a prayer like this look like? Well, let me give you an example. It means coming to God and saying, God, we want your name to be exalted. God, we want your name to be magnified above every name in the universe. We want all glory and praise and honor to come to you and you alone. So God, move for your glory. Hallowed be your name. God, move for your glory. God, look around the earth. Look at all of the things on earth that are not as they are in heaven. I mean, look at the suffering in our world. Look at the people that are utterly lost in their sin and doomed to an eternal judgment if they don't hear and respond to the gospel. God, look at our church. God, there's a million things that we need. There's areas that we struggle to do, some of the most basic things. Areas we're not serving our sheep as well as we ought. God, look at where we're at. God, move for your glory. Bring your kingdom and your will to earth as it is in heaven. And God, as we pray these things, as I pray these things, our first prayer needs to be this: move in me first. We're normally looking everywhere but us. Move in me first. Cause me to see what you see. Cause me to feel what you feel. Cause me to care as you care. Because the sad truth and reality of my life is that I rarely have the kind of compassion that Jesus has in this verse. And God, if you want, like, you're the Lord of the harvest, cause me to go instead of assuming that you're always going to use somebody else. Cause me to look at my schedule and my calendar and to say there are things that for God's glory need to come off of my calendar. My calendar is all about me and it's not about the kingdom. My focus is on me, it's not on the kingdom. Move in me first. Yet as you know, Father, the urgent and never-ending needs in my church, in my country, and the world in which I live are massive. So God, move in your people. Move in your people. Raise up the workers that we so desperately need. Workers we need right now in our local church. We have a diaconal position right now that we've been seeking to fill. It meets congregational needs. It's all about shepherding. And God knows we need it. Be praying with us that God would supply that person or that couple. God, raise up our church members. Raise up our children. Raise up our children to serve your kingdom. In whatever way you see fit. And that's going to mean that some of you aren't going to have your family staying in the area and living around you. It means God's going to take them somewhere. Raise up our kids. Raise up all of your people around the world. Cause us to sense a true sense of urgency of the need, the way that your son sensed that need. God, cause compassion to well in our hearts that we can no longer remain comfortable in our inaction. We can no longer remain comfortable in our apathy. God, send. Send us, send them, send your people into your field and do as you please. Like, we have a God who says, my ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts. So God, do it. Move in your people that we might give ourselves wholly to your mission to care for broken people, to save sinful men from the penalty of our sin. Move in us to extend your kingdom across this planet through the faith-filled proclamation of the gospel. Move for your glory. Move in me first and move in your people. It's a simple way to pray. Way to pray what Jesus has called his disciples to pray. And it's a way to pray the very beginning of the Lord's Prayer that we were given. Now, is it possible that God might choose to raise up laborers when no prayer has been offered? Of course. Our God is God. He's not limited by us. But we need to embrace this call to prayer because, number two, prayer is one of the most basic ways that we express our faith to God. Prayer is one of the most basic ways that we express our faith to God. We've been in two chapters that have been focused on this issue of faith. Like, just think about it. In prayer, we're not just meditating on our problems and hoping to figure out a solution, though that's what much of our prayer life can be sometimes alone, right? We start praying about something, then we start thinking about how we're going to fix it instead of just giving it to God. No, when we come to God in prayer, like, we're bringing our needs and our concerns and our requests to our Father, the omnipotent creator and sovereign ruler of the universe. And these prayers are one of the most basic ways that we express our faith in action. Because our prayer is an expression of our utter dependency on His grace and an acknowledgement of His sovereign power over all things. That's what's going on in prayer. So the call is to bring our every need. Bring our every concern, our every sorrow to God in our ever imperfect faith, because we know our faith is never perfect. Bring it. And as you pray, don't give up. Keep asking. Keep seeking. Keep knocking as Christ called us to. Because as we learned a couple studies ago in James chapter 4, God will not do for us apart from prayer what He's promised to do only through prayer. Prayer is the means that God has given us, and it is the way that He acts in this world. Let's close in a word of prayer.